This is a CBC podcast.
If they don't want to build more housing, if they don't want to solve this housing crisis, then they don't have to take our money. But we are there to work in partnership with any province that wants to show leadership and ambition in how we're going to work together to solve the housing crisis.
Justin Trudeau's budget plans run right through the Premier's backyards. I'm Catherine Cullen, and this week on The House, we've got the finance minister on whether her government is picking a fight with the provinces and whether the deficit is about to grow. Also,
so where Justin Trudeau and the NDP want to raise the cost of traditional energy that we still need, I want to lower the cost of carbon-free alternatives.
Pierre Poilievre says he's got the best plan for the environment. So what is it? We'll take a look at what he said about climate change and what options are left if he axes the carbon tax. Plus, we go to the War Museum with the UK and US ambassadors and ask whether NATO needs protection from another Donald Trump presidency. First, the 2024 budget extravaganza. The House is now in session. Did you hear about the budget announcement on Monday or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday? You'd be forgiven for missing the fact the budget isn't out for 10 more days. But the Liberals are going full blast with their plans now, including lots on housing and a school food program. Many of the plans require buy-in from the provinces, some of whom aren't thrilled with the Prime Minister and the federal government these days. So, can the federal government actually make this all happen? I spoke with Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland while she was in Toronto on Thursday to find out. A lot of the programs the government is announcing rely on the provinces to cooperate. The billions in housing infrastructure actually have baked into the plan that if the provinces won't agree to your conditions, you're basically going to go around them straight to the municipalities. Is it that you're not concerned that you're entering into provincial turf here, or do you welcome these fights with the premiers?
You know, Catherine, I would start with what it is that we need to accomplish. And that is, as a country, we just need to build more homes faster. And, you know, what I hear everywhere that I go is that this is one of the most pressing, if not the most pressing challenges our country is facing. It is absolutely urgent. And what I also hear from Canadians is, given what a big deal this is in the lives of everybody, Canadians expect the federal government to play a central role. And so that's what we're doing. Now, we also really believe it is such a big challenge that it is going to take a Team Canada effort to get all the homes built that Canadians need.
But is it Team Canada to say, if you guys don't do what we want, we're going straight to the municipalities? It doesn't sound like you're necessarily on the same team.
We 100% are on the same team. And what I would say is, you know, we think what it's going to take is federal government, provincial government, municipalities, private sector, public sector, all of us working hard on many different fronts, really, really focusing on this. Now, when it comes to the provinces, I do think that Canadians expect the federal government to get real bang for our buck. When the federal government is investing in housing, they want to be sure those investments are going to deliver housing. And what we really believe, and I feel like there's a real change in the country right now. I think people really understand we have to do housing differently. I am also extremely optimistic that we are going to be able to find ways to work together with every single province and territory across the country. And the example I'll give you is early learning and childcare. I remember when we put that forward, so many people said to me, great idea, but totally impossible. The provinces will never play ball. And look, they all have. I think when people, we're all elected by the same people. I think we all recognize every single elected leader in the country. Canadians want us to get more homes built faster. And Canadians expect us to do it together. And I'm confident that's what we'll do.
On that note, Minister Freeland. The Prime Minister said on Thursday there are instances where, quote, the provinces have to be encouraged to do more. Doesn't that suggest that you think your government knows better than some of these premiers?
What I think we recognize as a federal government is we need to have a big shift in our whole approach as a country to housing. We need to welcome gentle density. We need to cut through red tape. We need to find ways to really, really speed up how fast we're building homes and get them built where people live. I think that that's where Canadians are, and that is going to be what the federal government pushes for in all of our conversations with municipalities, with provinces and territories. And I really want to emphasize the role of private sector, the role of charities, of not-for-profits. There are lots and lots of players that need to be involved, and we are working with all of them.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these conditions that you're trying to put forward, and municipalities specifically, because you're saying, well, listen, if the provinces won't work with us, the municipalities perhaps will. I'd like you to listen to Mayor Tom Marakis of Aurora, Ontario, north of Toronto. Here's what he told me about the conditions the federal government is putting forward for this infrastructure money.
To me, I feel like they're micromanaging a little bit too much. We're moving forward with eliminating minimum parking requirements in our major transit station area. We're moving forward with, as of right, four stories on our main corridors. And we're also moving forward with looking at implementing the fourplexes townwide. Now, that doesn't mean that every municipality should do it. And to me, implementing a one-size-fits-all approach and tying it to funding and saying you're not going to get funding for the infrastructure that's needed to allow for growth, to me, I just don't think that's appropriate.
In fact, Minister, he told me that the federal government should stay in its lane and that it's municipalities' jobs to do this kind of planning. What do you say?
Well, let me first of all say to the mayor, I am so glad that he recognizes that it is time to do away with minimum parking requirements near major transit. I am glad to hear the mayor embracing gentle density. And I think that it is absolutely the federal government's job to do everything we can, including creating some positive incentives to encourage municipalities across the country to embrace that approach. I talk to mayors, and some of them off the record, when there are no microphones around, will say, we love the fact that there is conditionality because we know this is the right thing to do, and we can explain it more easily to our city councils, to our communities, when we say, look, this is the right thing to do, and the federal government is giving us a really positive incentive as a community to do this. I think that's a role of the federal government.
This is the role of the federal government. Well, I think you would at least acknowledge, even if some mayors are telling you privately they like it, that there's a bit of a debate there. But I want to move on to the school food program, which I know is something you're going to want to talk about as well. Your government hopes to get it in place for the next school year. It's $1 billion over 5 years, again, to fund school meals. Again, more negotiations with the provinces required. Are you promising things that you don't have a lot of control in delivering in terms of getting this money out the door by the time of the next school year?
Well, what I would say on school food is that there is a huge patchwork of programs across the country. We see provinces, territories, municipalities, school boards, not-for-profits, all working on this. And really, the fact that so many people in so many different areas and organizations are working on the issue is one of the things that gives me the confidence that Canadians know this is the right thing to do. And what the federal government is doing is we're saying it is the right thing to do. Kids should not be coming to class hungry. They shouldn't be distracted by that. And the federal government is going to help all the people across the country who are already working on this by providing a little more money.
But my question is about the timeline.
That's what gives me the confidence. Yeah. That's what gives me the confidence. I guess what I'm saying, Catherine, is we're not starting from scratch. There are programs available already across the country, and what we're doing is providing some more support so more kids can get some nutritious food in their tummies before they have to start learning.
You have announced billions in new spending in just a few days. And I know some of it was loans, but billions of it wasn't. Is the deficit about to get bigger?
No.
How are you going to pull that off?
Well, there is more to come, and we will have a lot of things to say on budget day. But what I really want to say, Catherine, is, you know, what we have recognized is that right now there are some urgent priorities. There are some places where Canadians really need investment. We need investment in housing. We need investment in affordability. We need investments to grow our economy. And we need to do it all in a way that supports generational fairness. We really need to be sure that young Canadians have a chance, that the promise of Canada is there for them. Part of making sure that we fulfill the promise of Canada for young Canadians is to ensure that we do it in a fiscally responsible way. That is something we're really committed to, because the younger generation, you know, we can't leave them with an irresponsible fiscal position. And so we won't.
So, Minister, I appreciate that you want to leave a rabbit or two in your hat for budget day. But if you say to me the deficit isn't getting any bigger, but we are adding more spending, cuts seems to be the only route forward.
In the fall economic statement, Catherine, we laid out some fiscal guideposts and we said, this is going to be the fiscal framework in which we're going to operate. We were serious about that, and we're going to stick to that fiscal framework.
Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the American ambassador about NATO. They have been urging Canada to come up with a plan to meet the pledge to get to 2% of GDP defense spending. Will you increase military spending beyond what you've already announced in this next budget?
We have been making lots of announcements, and there are going to be announcements to come. I'm not going to make an announcement on your program about defense spending.
But there's a defense spending announcement to come. I just like some clarity here, please.
I'm not making an announcement today about defense spending one way or the other. But what I will say is Canada today is one of the biggest spending partners in NATO. Canada today is one of the countries that is doing the most per capita to address what I believe is NATO's most pressing challenge, which is support Ukraine in its war against Russia. In March, Canada sent $2 billion of urgent budget financing support to Ukraine at a time when the U.S., and this is maybe something you could ask the U.S. ambassador about, at a time when the U.S. has been unable to step up and provide support for Ukraine. We were there to fill the gap. So I'm not making an announcement about defense spending today, but I do want people listening to know that Canada is there as a strong partner, a strong ally, meeting some of the most pressing security challenges of the day. And particularly when it comes to NATO, you know, there is Canadians can, you know, stand up tall and proud knowing that our country is absolutely doing our part to resist Russia, support Ukraine, which is NATO's biggest fight.
So in that vein, and I will just note, Canada, though, is not, I have not seen a path to meet 2% of GDP, but I want to ask you about Ukraine, and I know it's a topic you're very passionate about. NATO is looking to set up a 100 billion euro five-year fund for Ukraine. Is Canada prepared to contribute new money to such a fund?
Again, I have no announcements, no fresh announcements to make on defense today. But on Ukraine, I think it's worth noting that on the second anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there were European leaders there. There was Italy as the leader of the G7. There was Belgium, which has the chair of the EU in Kyiv. And there was one non-European country there, and that was Canada with Prime Minister Trudeau. We announced a security agreement with Ukraine. The Prime Minister said in Kyiv on February 24th, offering his personal physical solidarity, and he said, we're going to be there with $3 billion this year, more than $3 billion this year for Ukraine in economic and military support. Canada is totally doing its share. Canada, in fact, is a leader in supporting Ukraine right now. And I would be very interested in hearing what the U.S. ambassador has to say about the shenanigans in Congress, where we are seeing the aid and support Ukraine urgently needs being blocked. That is a problem. Canada's support for Ukraine is not Ukraine's problem.
Minister, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time.
Really nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. And we apologize for the sirens in the middle of that interview. The minister joined us from Toronto.
I'm going to give you a lightning tour of our Gallery 4. We'll be passing through the founding of NATO through to the Cold War.
75 years ago this week, the NATO military alliance was founded. NATO's resolve and its significance has been tested lately, particularly by Vladimir Putin. To mark the anniversary, we visited the Canadian War Museum for a special tour focused on NATO. Museum historian Andrew Birch had some fun facts about the origins of the alliance.
The music accompanying the signing was by the United States President's own Marine Corps band playing I've Got Plenty of Nothing and If I Knew You Were Coming at a Baked a Cake, which is kind of an interesting but collegial opening to a very key alliance.
On this tour are some key members of the NATO alliance, including Finland's ambassador, Jari Viljanen. His country joined NATO 1 year ago in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
In 72 hours after the war started, Finnish people decided that the only way to secure our future and our children's future is to join the NATO. It was people's will and the politician then followed it. And today Finland probably is the strongest supporter of the NATO membership. 90% of the Finns support the NATO membership and 90% of Finns are willing to commit our troops also to defending our alliances, including the Canada and Canadians.
So we'll just head into the post-Cold War section. We'll be passing by a section of the Berlin Wall. This is an actual piece of the Berlin Wall that was donated by the Republic of Germany after reunification.
While NATO members have come together to support Ukraine, there have also been challenges. Donald Trump threatened to upend the alliance when he was president, and there are worries about what he'll do if he's reelected. I asked American Ambassador David Cohen how he would describe this moment in NATO's history.
Well, I think the 75th anniversary is something to celebrate, and it does give us an opportunity to reflect on the value of NATO, the growth of NATO, and the importance of NATO in preserving democracies globally. And as I look at the state of NATO and the state of affairs on this 75th anniversary, I think all 32 members of NATO have every right to be enormously proud of the alliance that has been created, the power of that alliance. You're absolutely right that the alliance is being tested, but I think it is coming through with flying colors, and I think that NATO is stronger than it's ever been, and we're collectively standing up to the pressures that we're all facing.
As the members of the alliance look to the future, there is this discussion of a 100 billion euro five-year fund for Ukraine, with the suggestion from some parts that it would be an effort to Trump-proof the organization. What do you think of that proposal?
So I don't want to comment on a need to proof aid to Ukraine because of the outcome of a presidential election in the United States. I do think that the discussion is reflective of the universal support and commitment of NATO as an alliance and of all of the members of that alliance to make sure that we are in a position to provide long-run, long-standing, reliable support to Ukraine. As President Biden has said, the United States is going to be there for Ukraine for as long as it takes. And this type of a fund is, I think, an excellent way to make sure that the support of NATO and all of the allies will be there for Ukraine as long as it takes.
You personally, since you have been here in Ottawa, have pushed the Canadian government to do more to live up to its NATO spending obligations in your public comments, reaching that 2% of GDP target, which Canada does not have a path to. Do you see any signs that the Canadian government is heeding your encouragement?
So, Catherine, you know I hate to be picky with reporter questions, but I've been very careful to talk about my advocacy in terms of the need for Canada to invest properly in defense preparedness, to be able to continue to increase spending. And I've been equally clear that I don't think it's fair to assess Canada's performance or commitment to defense by reference to any single metric. And obviously there is this focus on percentage of GDP, which is the whales commitment standard. When the president visited Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau and the president issued a joint statement in which Canada and the United States jointly recommitted to the importance of the whales pledges and for all members of NATO to be able to get to at least 2% of GDP's defense spend as a floor, not as a ceiling. But we've seen significant investments by Canada in defense in the 2 years that I've been here. We look at things beyond the percentage of GDP, but we look at trajectory of spend, and the trajectory of Canada's spend has been very high. We look at Canada's responsiveness to requests for defense assistance and security. So we look at the $4 billion that Canada has committed to Ukraine running through 2029. We look at the commitments that Canada has made in the Indo-Pacific. We look at the commitments Canada has made for NORAD modernization and as part of its Arctic strategy. We look just in the last year at the procurements that Canada has done to purchase 140 state-of-the-art aircraft for $44 billion.
I'm going to jump in here, Ambassador, because we only have a moment left. And Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, we spoke to her for this show about whether Canada was going to be making new investments in military spending in the budget. She said she wouldn't reveal what was in the budget, but when we talked about international pressure, she said, she suggested I ask you about the U.S. being, quote, unable to step up and provide support for Ukraine because of what she described as the shenanigans in Congress. Okay.
So I've no desire to debate Chrystia Freeland when she isn't even here, but I'm enormously proud and I will stand at the $77 billion that the United States has devoted to Ukraine, $77 billion U.S. dollars, including $44 billion in military assistance, which is more military assistance than all of the other countries in the world combined. So I'll stand on that record every day and be very proud of it. And I will note that the United States has continued to provide support to Ukraine, even with the difficulties of navigating the Congress and the democratic process. But I will note that this is not because there's opposition to aid to Ukraine. Democracy can be a little ugly at times, and it can be a little cumbersome. In the end, democracy works, and I have no doubt that the United States Congress will step up and that there will be an ongoing flow of continued significant support to Ukraine from the United States.
American Ambassador David Cohen.
And one of the key things that Canada and allies were grappling with in the United Nations mission in the former Yugoslavia was that there was no peace to keep. And so rather than risk greater ethnic cleansing and greater embarrassment of the international community, gradually NATO became more and more involved in the resolution of that conflict.
Susanna Goshko, the British High Commissioner, is also on the tour of the Canadian War Museum. I asked her what she would say to Canadians about defense spending being a priority right now.
Well, you know, here we are today talking on the 75th anniversary of NATO, and NATO has never been more relevant than it is today. The reality of this is that though we would like to live in a world that is free from conflict, we're living in a world that is increasingly conflicted and contested, and we need to meet the world where it's at. And so in the UK, we spend about 2.3% of our GDP on defence. We've been one of the lead proponents on the 2% commitment dating back to the 2014 summit, which we hosted in Wales, and we've made a commitment to get to 2.5% by 2025. We would encourage all countries to set out a clear pathway to meet 2% because we're clear that NATO needs investment in its deterrence for it to be the most effective organisation to meet the challenges of the world today.
Do you get any indications from Canadian officials that there is a willingness to chart a path to 2%?
Well, we're looking forward to seeing what the defence policy update will say. But the key thing is that when Canada came to Vilnius last year, they were part of the defence investment pledge that was clear that 2% should be the minimum that NATO countries should spend on defence and not the ceiling that we were aiming for. So we were delighted that they were able to make that commitment.
We know there is a conversation going on right now about a longer-term fund that would, as some have put it, Trump-proof NATO. Do you think that there is a need to Trump-proof the alliance?
I'm not going to get drawn into that. That's not a comment for me to make. What I would say is that the really clear commitment from all countries to 2% is the best prospect we have of making sure that NATO is fit for the challenges of the future, because the reality is that part of the strength of NATO is our unity. It's about how we come together and show collective sense of purpose. And I would like to focus at the 75-year point on how well we've done that. We have guaranteed peace in Europe for the last 75 years. That's a remarkable thing. And so, yes, there are definitely challenges at the moment, including with what's going on with Russia-Ukraine. And our focus on maintaining commitment to Ukraine is really essential. But we should also take a moment to recognise that when we all believe and come together in NATO, we can do remarkable things together.
I'll show you some of those and talk about NATO and its contemporary implications.
That was UK High Commissioner Susanna Goshko ending our tour at the Canadian War Museum. Lots more coming up on the House podcast, including the MP who forgot about a busload of international students who showed up to vote at his nomination, and what else we learned from this week's foreign interference inquiry. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to the podcast that helps you make sense of the political decisions that affect your life. A new episode of The House drops every Saturday. You can find news and interviews on our website, cbc.ca/The House.
Last summer, Mr. Poilievre, Canada experienced the worst wildfire season ever. We just had the hottest winter ever recorded. What is your carbon plan beyond axing the tax? What do you say to Canadians who don't think you have a plan?
We're the only party that has a climate plan and an environmental plan. And that is technology and not taxes. We need to green light.
Last week, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre told news channel CP24 that he has the only plan to fight climate change, though the Liberals say otherwise.
Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives have exactly zero solutions to propose for any of these challenges. They are not putting forward an alternative. They are recognizing and amplifying the frustration and anger people are feeling. But they are not providing solutions in any way, shape, or form for climate change, for affordability.
Given all the recent debate around the carbon tax, the House wanted to figure out what exactly Pierre Poilievre's plan is and whether it's better than the carbon tax.
Like I said, I don't take issue with the idea of trying to reduce our emissions in order to combat climate change, but I don't think...
Poilievre told the National Post late last year that he doesn't object to reducing emissions. But one important question is, by how much? Canada has committed to meeting its emissions targets under the Paris Agreement. In November, Poilievre was asked if he would support Canada's international climate commitments.
Will you sign on to the 2030 target?
Will you support the 2030 targets?
That's a good question.
Let's see how far off Justin Trudeau's carbon tax disaster is for meeting those targets, because so far...
He didn't make any commitments. That same month, he was asked in French about whether he would withdraw from the Paris Treaty.
Est-ce qu'un gouvernement conservateur se retirerait de l'accord de Paris sur le climat?
On ne propose pas ça.
He said, we are not proposing that. So, what do we know about what the Conservatives are proposing when it comes to reducing emissions? Poilievre has laid out some priorities, and he repeats them often. First, there's a big emphasis on technology.
Where Trudeau proposes taxes, I propose technology. Where he proposes to raise the cost of traditional energy we still need, I propose to lower the cost of alternatives. We need to speed up small modular nuclear reactors that will supply clean, green, emissions-free electricity onto the grid. We need to support carbon capture and storage that will allow industry to put emissions back underground where it came from.
Also, reducing regulations.
That means quickly approving hydroelectric dams in, for example, Quebec, which needs to double its output of hydroelectricity over the next several decades in order to meet the demand for emissions-free energy. We need to green light tidal wave power off the East Coast, the kind that Trudeau blocked with years of bureaucracy.
Now, we've asked to interview Pierre Poilievre more than a dozen times since he became leader because we'd like to understand more about his policies. No luck yet. And when we asked for the party's environment critic for this segment, we received a quote from an answer Mr. Poilievre recently gave in a news conference. But we still want to explore the issue of just what a Poilievre government might do on the environment. To make sense of what we do know and what questions still need to be answered, I'm joined by Michael Bernstein. He's the executive director of Clean Prosperity, a climate policy organization that has provided independent advice to various political parties. That includes the federal government and Pierre Polyev's team. And Nicholas Rivers, an associate professor of public policy at the University of Ottawa. He was one of many academics who recently signed an open letter supporting carbon pricing. Welcome to the House to you both.
Thanks very much.
Good to be here.
So Pierre Polyev says he has the best plan. The Liberals say he has no plan. Michael, I'll start with you. How would you sum up what we've seen from Polyev so far on the environment?
Well, so far, really what we've seen is a tagline to a movie, or maybe, you know, the first couple of seconds of the trailer. So it's a little bit hard to assess this because really what we need to see is the feature film. So all that is to say that we have a general sense of his approach, but we don't know really any of the details yet.
Nicholas, is it a plan?
I would have said it's less than a general sense at this moment. We have heard a buzzword, technology, but we haven't heard much about the policy that would support technology diffusion. I think that's where the rubber hits the road. Is he talking regulations or subsidies or other mechanisms to support technology? I think until those are made clear, we don't really know what's the plan.
Okay, so let's dig into that. And Michael, I'll turn to you here. Pierre Polyev says he wants to lower the cost of alternatives, so cleaner energy. Can you talk about how he might do that?
Yeah, well, as Nick said, there really are at a high level a couple of options. I mean, the first is to just try to make those clean technologies less expensive, because ultimately the challenge here is some of these clean technologies cost more than the fossil fuel alternatives. So you do have the option to subsidize those technologies. The second choice, of course, is to make the existing fossil fuel technologies more expensive. That is ultimately part of the purpose of a carbon price. And the third option here is regulation, essentially mandating that these technologies need to be used. Now, I think we do need to think about technologies in a couple of different buckets, because you have technologies that are suitable for industrial facilities. Think about steel mills and cement kilns, chemical refineries. That's where things like carbon capture, hydrogen, industrial heat pumps are going to be needed. And then you have the consumer side of the economy, where we're talking about electric vehicles, heat pumps, and other types of lower cost equipment. So the policies are going to be different for depending on the technology that we're trying to advance.
Nicholas Rivers, when we look at what Pierre Polyev wants to do, he also wants to balance the budget. So I wonder, can the government lean in on technology subsidies without these kinds of like eye-popping sums that we're seeing in the United States?
A lot of what Michael just mentioned, things like subsidies for large decarbonization in industry or on the home side, or regulations or price changes to make fossil fuel technologies more expensive, we have a lot of that stuff already under the current government, right? So a new emission reductions from a Polyev government would require something in addition to what we already have, and we haven't heard that yet.
Does it seem clear to you that the most obvious way to do it is subsidies, and I guess as you're pointing it to, above and beyond the tens of billions of dollars in tax credits that the Liberals have already proposed for industry?
I think driving decarbonization with subsidies is going to get too expensive. I think the real place that we need to focus on for deep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions has to be regulations. We can use subsidies especially to promote technologies that aren't mature yet. And Polyev in the clip mentioned small modular reactors, for example. Mm-hmm. Those are not well developed yet. There's no commercial installations anywhere. So subsidizing that technology to allow the first few installations to be completed makes a lot of sense. But we can't afford to subsidize our way to zero emissions. It has to be something where we require individuals and companies to use zero emission technologies.
I feel like regulation is one of those words that maybe puts people to sleep sometimes because it sounds like it sounds complex, red tape. Can you just paint a really clear picture for me of an example of how regulations would work in this way?
Yeah. So we have regulations on coal-fired power plants, which basically say you can't build them anymore. Coal is the dirtiest way to produce electricity, and we have ruled it out as part of the electricity generating portfolio in Canada.
What do you think about that, Michael, then? Is regulation the place you would expect them to look?
Well, I think actually the foundation for an effective climate policy, and one that I hope Mr. Polyev will adopt, will be an industrial carbon pricing system, which can be thought of as a regulation sometimes. But essentially what this is charging a carbon price on these heavy industrial facilities, the steel, the concrete, the chemicals, pulp and paper. That is how we are going to cost effectively reduce emissions in those sectors. And we can do it smartly. We can do it in combination with protections at our border to make sure that our industry is still able to compete with international competitors. We can add policies like carbon contracts for difference, which is essentially like a form of insurance that gives the confidence to these industrial facilities that carbon pricing and the rules around carbon pricing are going to be here for the long term so they can go ahead with these very large ticket investments. So I would say the foundation really would be an industrial pricing system. And then there will be targeted regulations that can complement that approach.
And it's worth noting that the Canadian Climate Institute just put out a report that shows that industrial carbon pricing has three times the impact on greenhouse gas emissions as the consumer tax. Is that the soundest approach, though, if we're trying to do this in a way, Michael, that both drives down emissions and manages the cost?
Yeah, we have a really big challenge on our hands to transform our economy over the next 25 years. And we have to do it probably with some subsidies, but of course that will get expensive. And so providing a carbon price is the smartest way because it provides flexibility. And this is very different, just to be clear, from the consumer carbon tax that most people think about. This is a different system that's essentially unrelated to the consumer side. But what it does is it gives those industrial facilities the flexibility either to reduce their emissions and avoid paying the carbon price or to continue to pay the price if they find it too expensive in the short term to make changes.
Nicholas, I'd like to ask you about another argument that we often hear from conservative-leaning voices, and in some ways is being echoed by Mr. Polyev. Former Alberta Premier Jason Kenney made this argument on our program just a few weeks ago, that it is more prudent for Canada to sell its energy overseas and help drive down emissions from places that are still using coal. Why not do that?
I think it's a complicated question. My easy answer is that selling more fossil fuel is never a good answer to the climate problem. But I think that if we could guarantee that bringing more natural gas to market would only have the effect of displacing coal, there's a kind of a simple truth to it. I would also argue that natural gas is not like a long-term pathway that's consistent with reaching net zero emissions, which is what we're trying to do and what we've committed to do. So I think it can be at best a short-term step. And that I would, again, reiterate that bringing more fossil fuel to market is not consistent with our climate targets.
Michael, what do you think about that argument? Because it is one that we hear often.
Well, I would first say that I think there is absolutely a role for Canada to help the world reduce emissions. And I think there's reason to believe that Canada can export technologies, whether that be carbon capture, whether that be nuclear. And I'm really hopeful about carbon dioxide removal technologies as well and the role that Canada can play there. When it comes to natural gas, I think, as Nick said, there are situations where that can reduce emissions. The problem is it's really hard to know when you're in that situation versus when that actually isn't helping solve the problem. So I'm not strong one way or the other on this. What I think we really need to do is make sure that if we are moving forward with that approach, we have really transparent processes around evaluating how it is actually reducing emissions. But I think more focus should be placed on some of these other clean technologies.
So given all the options that we've talked about, can the Conservatives put forward a plan that would reach the same targets, the same climate goals that the Liberals are currently eyeing? Like if you take the carbon tax out of the equation and we look at the things that Pierre Poilievre has said he's committed to, are those objectives still achievable?
Well, the objective that the Liberals have set for 2030, which is now just 5 years away, is going to be incredibly difficult to achieve. So I think that whether it's the federal government's policy or whether it's a Poilievre policy, there is going to be a challenge in the short term. When we're talking about possibly a longer horizon, say 2035, I think there is absolutely a way for Mr. Poilievre to have an effective plan anchored ideally on this industrial carbon pricing program we talked about that can make significant progress in reducing emissions in Canada and help support decarbonization globally.
Nicholas?
Yeah, I think if we lose the consumer carbon price, which is pretty clearly going to happen if Poilievre gets elected, we'll get further away from our goals. So the recent Canadian Climate Institute report suggests that that policy alone is responsible for about 10% of our target. So losing it would take us 10% further away. Conceivably, the government could introduce something that would replace the consumer carbon price. It hasn't yet articulated what that would be. And so I think we're still in the dark about whether it would get towards our goals.
In closing, if we look at where Pierre Poilievre is in the polls, is riding high. If we look at the political debate right now around the carbon tax, I wonder, and I'll start with you, Nicholas, how much do you think his environmental plan is going to matter to his political fortunes in the next election?
It's not at all clear at this point. He, like you say, he's up 15 points in the polls and has not articulated a climate plan yet. So I would guess that if he remains up 15 points in the polls, he's unlikely to articulate a complete climate plan before the election. And I'm not sure where that will put him come the election. But I do think that the majority of Canadians care about the climate. This is consistently found in polling. But whether he can assemble a big enough coalition that is kind of more ambivalent, I guess time will tell.
Michael, what do you think?
So under the current environment, it's certainly the case that he could win government without a climate plan. But I think the more salient question is, why would he want to? Why would he not want to give himself the best chance of winning government? And giving yourself the best chance would be trying to appeal to those voters, particularly suburban voters, that we know do care about climate change. They may not know all the details, but I think they want to know that their leaders are serious about the issue. And furthermore, there are conservative solutions, and particularly small-c conservative solutions, solutions that leverage the market, that promote technology, that can be effective in addressing climate change. So why not lay out a positive agenda and help his electoral case at the same time?
Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Michael Bernstein of Clean Prosperity and Nicholas Rivers of the University of Ottawa.
We have detected and reported on some foreign interference activities during those elections. However, I am very comfortable with the decision the panel reached that they did not impact the integrity.
That's CSIS head David Vigneault with a public inquiry into foreign interference this week, offering something of a defense of how security officials responded to election interference. But the inquiry also heard powerful arguments of how interference was upending lives and potentially corroding the democratic system. The CBC's Janice McGregor has been following the inquiry all week. She's here to help us make sense of it. Janice, thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome.
So, former Special Rapporteur David Johnston warned that the challenge in a public inquiry would be this issue of how much can actually be made public. How big a challenge is it now that this inquiry is actually happening?
A very big one. It's weird. I'm not going to lie to you, Catherine. I have been sitting in a room with people who know a lot of things that I am not allowed to know and that they are not allowed to tell me. And journalists are curious people. We aren't cool with that. Look, Commissioner Ugg has gone to great lengths to try to strike the right balance here. Remember, we had a whole week of hearings back in the winter about how to accomplish this. All the players weighed in. And it's led to some kind of creepy innovations like
creepy.
What we had at the end of the week where a CSIS representative it was kind of referred to only as, you know, the voice, right? Answering questions without us being able to see this person or know the name of this person, but nevertheless give factual testimony. But the most tantalizing aspect has to be these summaries of classified intelligence that they are presenting to us. What an interesting read they are. The Modi government is using proxy agents to spray money around. And in 2021, they were active in several specific ridings. And it is super, super interesting to hear, as we did this week, that CSIS yanked a foreign interference assessment it had made about the nomination meeting in Don Valley North. Of course, one of the kind of instances at the heart of this inquiry, without telling us why. So, you know, you hear things like this and you're like, wow, tell me more. And yet, you know, they can't tell you more.
So what about the testimony from non-disembodied voices? What has been the most striking testimony you've heard so far?
No question. It's hearing the diaspora politicians really speak in plain terms about how this has been for them and what's at stake. Kenny Chiu and Jenny Kwan, for example, both from Greater Vancouver, These are experienced politicians, leaders in their community, you know, having party platforms that are very strong on human rights issues, critical of China, saying things that Beijing did not want to hear, and as a result, having to pay very personal prices. By their telling, the Chinese Communist Party apparently has enough of a hold over the diaspora community there that they are shunned from events. They were not welcome on certain, you know, ethnic media broadcasts in their own hometown. I want you to listen to Kenny Chu here talking about what happened when he was door knocking in the 2021 election.
As soon as they heard my Chinese name, Zhao Jingrong, they would shut the door in my face. And there have been families, a house I vividly remember door knocking, and they were very supportive in 2019. That they will vote for me, that they would actually allow us to put a lawn sign on their property. This time when we knock on the door, the lady who opened the door, I even remember her face, she had become emotional with a deep sense of hurt and hate. And she, I mean, we didn't bother asking for a lawn sign because she says she's not going to vote for us because we hate China, because we hate them.
Jenny Kwan described seniors in her riding pulling her in close, whispering in her ear because they were afraid to be seen talking to their own MP. They were afraid to vote because they thought there could be retributions for their family.
Very powerful there. It was a very different kind of experience when we heard from another politician who has been at the heart of this whole story. That's former Liberal MP, now independent MP, Han Dong.
Yeah. I was surprised, frankly, after the allegations he's faced, the way he became, willingly or not, fairly or not, kind of the face of foreign meddling for what happened in his riding, Don Valley North. I guess I expected him to come prepared with a vigorous defense of the integrity of that nomination meeting that chose him to run for the Liberals. Instead, he didn't seem to recall things, didn't seem to know things, wasn't sure the translation was right. Key details at the heart of this story, like the allegation that someone paid for a busload of foreign students to come in and vote for him, so he won, he just didn't seem sure about.
Let's come on to the buses, please. When you met with the commissioner, you recalled one bus. As of today, we're up to three, right?
When I had the interview, my memory had one bus, and then quickly, you know, I correct my records, and it was two buses that my campaign rented.
You say you did so quickly?
Sorry?
You say you corrected this quickly?
I think it was within days after the interview, I correct that it was two buses my campaign rented.
All right. Well, we only found out about it yesterday for it being a second bus, and then it turns out that a third bus came up over lunch.
Now, one of the issues at the heart of all of this, Janice, is around whether there should have been a warning about foreign interference, whether what intelligence officials knew should have been shared. How is that debate playing out?
Look, we know they can't share everything. The question is, how much are they going to share? Because they have to share something. We heard that over and over again from the directors of the campaigns representing all the parties to individual politicians who felt really hurt that the intelligence agencies knew things were going on in their riding but didn't let them know. Michael Chong, whose family we now know was targeted, he pointed out that other allies are much more transparent with their intelligence. They take the view that sunshine's a much better disinfectant and deterrent. On the other hand, you know, this inquiry is grappling with how much interference you have before you sound a public warning, right? Where do you draw all these lines? Aaron O'Toole, former conservative leader, told the inquiry he thinks the system failed, that it didn't sound a warning when it needed to, and that as a result, ridings in the Lower Mainland or Greater Toronto were treated like, he called it, a rounding error in the national result. He's of the view that if there's a finger on the scale anywhere, even in one riding, that is absolutely not okay.
We did not raise any of this on election night or in the weeks after because our democratic result was clear. And it was more important to me to safeguard our institutions and our democracy rather than to express disappointment in the loss of a few seats. But as I said, I've seen enough to know that the process last time failed and failed a lot of Canadians. I think this problem will only get worse. And so we have to create the tools to really have a robust system that values every single voter.
And we're going to get a very different perspective on this whole set of issues next week when we hear more testimony from Liberals, notably from the Prime Minister. Thanks for setting all of this up for us, Janice.
I'll be there. Thank you.
That is it for us this week. Our crew on the House is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Christian Pauslang, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. I'm Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.